Revelation chapter 7 is the chapter after Revelation chapter 6. Go figure, right? We talked about chapter 6 last class, chapters 4 and 5, the one before that, which was significant because not only are we making good progress when it comes to time, but we're also making application as to the symbols that we see. And I want to go back to chapter 6 just for a moment to remind us where we've been so we know where we're going, because everything kind of builds off the last picture. The major issue of what we're trying to accomplish in this class is get the overall theme of Revelation from the actual text, and then to make application to the first century and then to our century. Any commentary that you read from a secular source or from a denominational source, when it comes to the majority of the Bible, historical fact, archaeology, dates, timeline, etc., it's not that hard to figure out where the Bible information is right and when it's wrong. One area, though, that can be misconstrued very easily is salvation, the church, especially history after the book of Acts, and then the end times, essentially. The idea of the apocalypse or the unveiled writing, the end of the age, end of the world. So whenever you get a study Bible or a commentary from a denominational source, one little preface is be very careful with that study Bible when it comes to information in the book of Revelation. Because sometimes you'll find some good information, like some connections between passages that John wrote and what Daniel said, or what Ezekiel did, and so on. That's helpful for us. But when it comes to actually information from the book of Revelation, I've not seen a study Bible, for example, that's gotten it right. My first Bible ever given to me from my preacher was a King James Zondervan study Bible. And it was a great first Bible because that's the translation he used. So it was helpful for me to follow along with where he was. And the little notes at the bottom of the page were very helpful because they just kind of explain the passage in a very simplistic way for me to understand it. So I love giving out study Bibles for the first Bible someone gets or a new one. But when it comes to the book of Revelation, it's just all over the place. So you can't trust those resources and absolutely everything. But when it comes to the book of Revelation, we look in chapter 7 and we connect the dots from chapter 6. This is important for us because what we saw was the opening of the seals. So we saw the scroll that was given to the Lamb who was worthy, and therefore all the people in heaven and on earth rejoiced because he was worthy to loose the scroll. We made some comments about what the scroll could possibly symbolize for the people of the first century. What was a possible symbol for the scroll itself? What's that? The book? Okay. The scroll, the book. What's the scroll mean? What's it represent, you think? All right, so what did Jesus, being the only one who is worthy, bring into the world? He had a forerunner, John, right? John the Baptist or John the Immerser, and he was preparing the way for the Lord, and he was bringing in the ushering of the good news, right? The gospel. So when you look at Jesus being the only one who is worthy to take the scroll, the information that was sealed or hidden from people before who were unworthy, and then Jesus was the only one who was worthy to open the scroll or open the book, if you will, we see a symbol that Christ was the one who was worthy to bring into the gospel of the new covenant. So the scroll might represent the bringing of the gospel into the world, right? He was the only one who was authorized to loose those seals, to crack open those wax stamps, and to uncover the information contained within that particular parchment volume, right? So in the opening of those seals, one after the other, there are certain consequences for the gospel to be unleashed into the world, if you will. When the gospel came into the world, there was a moment of peace, and then there was tribulation and so on that we've seen from each of the scrolls being cracked open and revealed. There's a result. So the very end of what we saw was the sixth seal, which included what we find here, cosmic disturbances. It's the same exact language that we found in Matthew chapter 24 in our previous study. And the idea of this apocalyptic literature, this veiled writing to discover something in almost a poetic way, talking about the sun being turned to blood and the moon being blotted out and so on. All this language is very poetic, very flourished, because it's used for emphasis, right? There wasn't literally on AD 70 the sun removed from the sky, but it was like the whole world was so turned upside down that the sun wasn't shining anymore, right? So that's kind of the idea that we talked about in chapter 6 of Revelation, beginning in verse 12. There was a great earthquake, the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became like blood. It's not the idea of this being a literal event that we're looking forward to or looking back on. It's as if the sun stopped shining and the moon is no longer there, is the meaning behind it. And the stars of heaven fell to the earth as a fig drops its late figs when it's shaken by a mighty wind. So like we lose the fruit of the apple tree or the fig tree in a great storm, it's like the entire world's coming apart with the sixth seal being open. And the sky receded as a scroll when it's rolled up, and every mountain, every foundation of the earth, literally, and island, a safe harbor for people who are looking for protection, was moved out of its place. And the kings of the earth, the great men, the rich men, the commanders, the mighty men, every slave and free man hid themselves in the caves and in the rocks and of the mountains. So we're not talking about an event discussed here with the sixth seal that is the second coming of Christ, right? That can't be the case. We know when Christ comes back from other texts that it's going to be as a thief in the night, without warning, without any kind of message that it's actually taking place in just a few moments. If you have time to run and hide yourself, and then verse 16, to wish death upon yourself, we're not talking about the second coming here. We're talking about a great event which was brought in the first century because of the opening of those seals, the bringing of the New Testament age, in which we find the whole world being turned upside down. So, verse 16, they said to the mountains and the rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb, for the great day of his wrath has come, and who is able to stand? So the sixth seal that we find being opened brings about events in which the whole world is shaken and turned upside down by the bringing of the gospel. All right. So in chapter 7, to kind of continue that context as an introduction, we move forward and we see exactly what I do on most class occasions with you. Something happens, it gets my attention, and I go and chase that rabbit for a little while, right? Something pops up, I'm like, as a side note, let's talk about this for an hour and a half, right? That's how it normally happens. So here in chapter 7, before we get to the seventh seal, which is, of course, the next logical place for us to be, we've had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then, something else is going on. Chapter 7 is devoted to, in the first part at least, something else that he sees. And from my own personal study, and from my own personal interest, I guess, as a young man looking for the truth, chapter 7 is where a group that I was with for a little while kind of just lost their minds for a little bit. They just kind of looked at chapter 7 as the holy grail of exactly what we need to understand from the book of Revelation. So, chapter 7, the title that we have by some translators here is The Sealed of Israel. Now, how much have we talked about the physical nation of Israel in the book of Revelation thus far? I mean, really nothing. We've had the 24 elders before the throne. We suppose from most people that look at that say, all right, 12 apostles, 12 tribes of Israel makes 24. That makes sense. Why can't it be that? That makes logical sense to us. It may or may not be that. We're just kind of supposing based on that number, right? So we've not talked about Israel as a physical nation at all up until this point. But you'll find a lot of people that look at chapter 7 and they see Israel mentioned, and they go to literal the nation of Israel we talked about in the Old Testament, right? So in a book that is by no means literal in interpretation, to just randomly say, well, this has to be literal then in chapter 7, makes no sense to us, right? If you're looking at a book that's entirely figurative in its symbols and its meaning and what it's trying to convey, to just randomly say now we're talking about a literal nation with no precedent for that is probably the wrong way to go about it. So I say that because we have to kind of set the stage for what doctrines come from chapter 7, which are taken from a literal interpretation of what we read. So anyway, chapter 7, verse 1. After these things, so he's seeing a successive pattern or successive image of what he is to do. We'll see in just a few moments that in a more simplistic way, what's happening is John is being shown this revelation, these pictures, and he is in some way just sitting down and writing what he's seeing, and that's what he's supposed to be doing. And there's going to be a few things that when he sees it and starts to write, an angel says, don't write that yet. So he's seeing some things here that are not meant to be revealed. So the things that he does write are ready for them to be revealed to the world through John's writing. So chapter 7, verse 1. After these things, I saw the four angels standing at the four corners of the earth. And I don't know why this is still a thing, but there is a educational movement that's still thriving for some reason that we have been lied to for a very long time about the actual state of our solar system and our planet. This is a real thing. There are flat earthers still out there. People say, well, you can't believe the Bible and also believe that our world's a sphere. You can't, because it says the four corners of the earth. So all those images you've ever seen of our planet have been lies to try and change your perspective about our world, that we're just one speck of cosmic dust amongst billions of others, and we mean nothing. But the Bible is right, and it says there are four corners. You can't have four corners without it being a map, like being flat, right? What's the meaning of the four corners of the earth? Are there four corners of the earth? It's hard to have a corner on a sphere, right? I've never seen a soccer ball and said, oh, look at that corner right there, right? So obviously, this is a symbolic book, and this little phrase, four corners of the earth, is an ancient expression for from absolutely everywhere. If something comes from the north, the east, the south, and the west, it's coming from all over. So when you've got angels on the four corners of the earth, where is their domain? The question is, where isn't their domain, right? They are on this world is the meaning behind it. Anyway, I don't see how flat earthers can really still exist, but hey, it is what it is. Holding the four winds of the earth. Well, if there are four corners, there have to be four winds, right? So all the power, all the strength, all the spirit, if you will, of the earth, that the wind should not blow on the earth or on the sea or on any tree. So we've talked about a table of symbols, what sometimes symbols mean in different books of the Bible. The one here that stands out to me is the wind obviously shows the power of the Holy Spirit. It shows the power of human breath, even God's breath, because you have that word in the Greek that means spirit and breath and wind. They're all the same word. So context determines what we're talking about. Talking about human breath, God's spirit, the wind of the earth. You have to figure out which one is meant by the context. So that the wind should not blow on the earth, the sea, or any tree. God's spirit, God's presence has no power on the earth for this particular scene. All right. Verse 2. Then I saw another angel ascending from the east, having the seal of the living God. So we talked about the scroll, right? Had the seven seals on it. What are those seals? They're ways to seal up the contents of that message. You have kind of the medieval archetype in your mind of the king pouring wax on the document and pressing his signet ring into the wax and making a seal that's not to be broken by anyone who's not worthy or unauthorized, right? So that seal here is the power of authority from God, is the expression behind that. And he cried with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was granted to harm the earth and the sea, saying, "Do not harm the earth, the sea, or the trees until we have sealed the servants of our God on their foreheads." Now, another area in which people just lose all rationality is the idea of the mark of the beast and being sealed by the angel of God. What does that mean? Well, there's the expression from the Old Testament that they were to bind these things, talking about the law of Moses, on their hands and on their forehead. And how did some of the Jews react to that command of binding the law upon their hands and upon their foreheads? Anyone know what phylacteries are? You've seen Jews that had black leather straps wrapped around their arms and around their head. They have little boxes in which they write verses from the Torah, from the law of God, in there, roll it up, put it in the little box, and they bind it upon their hands and upon their forehead because God said so. That's a very literal interpretation of that command. What's another meaning that God could have meant instead of binding literally the law upon your hands and upon your forehead? What's an alternative way to express that? What you do and what you think. That's good old Tennessee right there, if I've ever heard it. What you do and what you think, folks, right? That's it. What you do with your hands, that's the figure of speech, the expression there, and what you think within your forehead, the idea of your mind being expressed. So when you look at verse 3, keeping in context the idea of the figurative nature of this book, don't harm the earth, the people of the earth, the sea, the masses of people that are out there, the trees, that which gives life to the earth, until we have sealed or impressed upon by the authority of God the servants of our God in their minds. So until everyone in their mind has the authority of God within it, don't hurt the people quite yet. That's one interpretation of what's meant here by the symbology. Now verse 4. And I heard the number of those who were sealed. So I heard the expression of exactly how many individuals, the people of God, were going to be impressed by the authority of God within their minds. 144,000 of all the tribes of the children of Israel were sealed. So the 144,000 is where some denominations just lose their mind and say, well, you know what that must mean? It must mean that only 144,000 Christians are going to be saved from the entirety of the Christian age. That's one thought. It's definitely a thought. It's worthy of consideration, to be fair, but we have a logical issue with that. If we know the number of how many people are going to be saved, and God knows that already, we have some questions about predestination and election, don't we? If God knows only 144,000, and we can track our history as the church, even in this country, and we have more than 144,000 good Christian men and women, we have a problem with most of them not being good enough to be saved and so on. That's an issue. But look here in this context again. 144,000. Let's get a bigger picture of what this group looks like. It's good to kind of connect these two dots together before we move further because we want to really impress upon us that the 144,000 here is by no means literal. Right? This is not a literal book by any means. So something is meant by that very specific number. If we look over in Revelation 14:4, we go back to our context let's see, verse 2. Verse 1. And then I looked, and behold, a lamb standing out on Mount Zion. Now, what's Mount Zion? Jerusalem. All right, that was a figure of speech for Jerusalem. Mountain, because it was built on a mountainside of the city of Jerusalem, and Zion was another name for Jerusalem. And with him, 144,000, having his father's name written on their foreheads. So we had the seal of God mentioned in our context and the father's name written in this context to show a parallel between those two things. And I heard a voice from heaven, like the voice of many waters and like the voice of loud thunder. And I heard the sound of harpists playing their harps. They sang, as it were, a new song before the throne, before the four living creatures and the elders, and no one can learn that song except the 144,000 who were redeemed from the earth. So now we know where these 144,000 group came from. Where'd they come from? The earth. They came from humanity, from where we are right now in our context. These are the ones who were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. All right, so any religious group that takes a literal number of 144,000 now has to contend with the literal fact that they're all sexual virgins, right? So there is religious groups around us today that believe that the elect of their number are considered a part of the 144,000, but they also have wives, husbands, and children. So they take a literal approach to the number and a figurative approach to Revelation 14:4 of them being virgins. They say, well, no, it says virgins, but what it really means is they were pure, they were not defiled by the sins of the earth, meaning they were redeemed. So one's literal, one's figurative. That's a problem with understanding the scripture, right? So to be fair, if one's literal, it all has to be literal. If one's figurative, I'll be figurative. That's the idea. Okay, so having said that, going back to our text, Revelation 4:7-5, there are enumerated for us the different tribes. Now, Dan and Ephraim are not mentioned here, and you have the addition of Manasseh and Joseph. So it's not the 12 tribes that we would think of traditionally. It's just a symbol of the people of Israel. You have Judah, Reuben, Gad, Asher, Naphtali, Manasseh, Simeon, Levi, Issachar, Zebulun, and Joseph and Benjamin mentioned here. The first one mentioned was Judah. Why do you think Judah is mentioned first? Okay, Jerusalem is in Judah. But why else do you think maybe Judah was mentioned first? Who? All right, Judah was the guy that was given the prophecy that there would be a king coming from his posterity, right? So you have Judah, all these other tribes mentioned. One interesting note about this is we find this Israel is mentioned. And there are a lot of groups that look at this and they think it's literal Israel. But there is an alternative view to Israel being called out here. And the alternative view is we're talking about the new Israel of God, meaning Christians, not Jews. And the reason we can say that, just one verse to kind of back that thought up, is Galatians 6:16. And as many as walk according to this rule, this standard, this measuring rod, peace and mercy be upon them and upon the Israel of God. So the transition from Israel as a state or as a nation to being a symbol of the followers of God, a transition with the new covenant. So we talk about Israel in the book of Revelation. One very possible interpretation of this is we don't literally mean Israel, we mean Christians. But we're not saying Christians because we're talking about the people of God. So we'll use the symbol of Israel to represent that, because in a figurative context, talking about Christians as Israel, a figurative number of 144,000 from each tribe being redeemed from the earth, the authority of God impressed upon their foreheads, upon their minds, and they are the ones who overcome. So one meaning behind this is This is what John is seeing. Everyone that makes it through the time of persecution in the church in a symbolic way. So when John is seeing the seals being opened, and then he sees this image of a very specific number of people, of the people of God, who are redeemed from the earth. They were not defiled by the sins of the world, by this fornication, this sexual morality of paganism. They are in heaven because God allowed them to be. It's the image that we see here in this text. Now, you have the 144,000, so it begs the question, what about everybody else? Good question. Verse 9. After these things, I looked, and behold, a great multitude which no one could number. So two camps, one that could be numbered, one that couldn't be numbered. Of all nations, tribes, peoples, and tongues. What's tongues mean? Languages, right. Standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed with white robes, with palm branches in their hands. What does the clothed with white robes indicate to us? Pure. They are redeemed from the earth. They are washed by the blood. They are, right, justified in God's sight. Palm branches in their hands. There was another occasion in which the people of God took up palm branches, right? Where was that? All right, the triumphant entry. We've kind of summarized that whole experience, right? He rode a donkey as prophesied, and they were waving palm branches, which is a symbol of victory and honor and pledging their allegiance, if you will, to the king. Verse 10, and crying out with a loud voice, saying, salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb. Now, we mentioned when we were reading it in chapter 4 that one possible realization of who it was that was on that great throne was the Father. And then you have Jesus introduced a little bit later. This kind of still fits that archetype of seeing God on the throne and the Lamb at his right hand. All the angels stood around the throne and the elders and the four living creatures and fell on their faces before the throne and worshiped God, saying, amen. Blessing and glory and wisdom, thanksgiving and honor and power and might be to our God forever and ever. Amen. So what do you see in this picture overall? Stepping back away from numerology for a second, looking at the panorama of this specific text thus far, we've seen a select group of people that were given the authority of God impressed upon their minds, redeemed from the earth, not defiled by sin, present before God. They were from all the people of God in that particular time frame. Then you find beyond that, the scope is stretched out to absolutely a huge number of people, innumerable, that are all worshiping before God and before Jesus, who are bowing down and expressing their praise and adoration to them for their work, for their glory, for their redemption. A picture of worship in heaven is what we've seen. So why do you think John interrupts the entire world being turned upside down by the loosing of these six seals to give us another picture of worship in heaven? How would that be encouraging to you? And no one knows. Are you afraid to speak? If you're going through persecution, and it seems like an easy or light thing to just say that you're no longer a Christian, make a sacrifice to Caesar, and get out of that persecution, and thus compromise your religious values from Jesus, or to go back to being a Jew for a little while persecution is still hot, and then kind of flip-flop back and over. When you're learning that there are people that are in the people of God that are going to lose their lives, their souls are under the altar of God, they're waiting for redemption, waiting for vengeance from the Lord, we see that the scroll being opened turned the world upside down. But through that and beyond that, the people of God are secure with the authority of Jesus. And everyone that believes is secure in worshiping God forever, is that going to encourage you to keep going? So one thing that I used to do, I no longer do it for obvious reasons. What I used to do is when I would read a novel, especially like a one-off novel, not a series, I would go to the very last chapter and just read the last couple of pages just to see, with no context, what happens. And then as I'm reading the book, I know what's going to happen, kind of. I know the characters mentioned, the events mentioned. I don't really have an understanding of why it's happening, how it's happening. I don't know the path of the story, but I know the ending of it, right? So as I'm reading, in my mind, I'm trying to figure out how all these pieces fit together to make the ending the way that I read it. When you're reading Revelation, you are reading the end of the book of life. We don't know the path that our stories individually, collectively, and through the entire Christian age are going to take. We don't know who's going to lose their life, who's going to go through sickness and die. We don't know these things. But we do know the ending. And no matter what happens to us as the character arc unfolds, we know how everything ends up. So when we look at Revelation, we see John stepping back for a moment and giving us the big picture, and then zooming in and giving the people of the first century a glimpse into what's taking place in a symbolic way, and then zooming back out, big picture again, zooming back in. So he's keeping his readers attentive to what he's actually showing them. Does that make sense? Okay. Now I love this. In verse 13, "And then one of the elders," so one of the 24 we assume, "said to me, 'Who are these arrayed in white robes, and where did they come from?'" Or from whence did they come, if you're speaking about proper English. Great question. John is kind of like us. "And I said to him, 'Sir, you know.'" Great answer. He says, "You know what? I will get back to you on that, but I'll tell you what, I'm sure you know the answer." Try that next time you're in class. If you have a teacher who's instructing you and they ask you a question, they go, "You know what? I think you know the answer to that question." "So he said to me, 'These are the ones who come out of the great tribulation.'" The great tribulation. That little phrase alone is enough to scare us, right? "And washed their robes and made them white and the blood of the Lamb." The only time that logic goes away from us is how we can dip something in crimson red blood and it come out white as snow. How's that happen? We don't know. You know, sir. I don't know. I have no idea how it happens. "Therefore, they are before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple. And he who sits on the throne will dwell among them." I wish I had time. I'm going to make time sometime. Maybe next Sunday. We'll see. This little phrase is so beautiful. And I wish I could just expound right now upon why it's so beautiful. And he who sits on the throne will dwell with them. That's what God has always wanted from his people. Anyway, we'll talk about that later. So, verse 16, "They shall neither hunger anymore, nor thirst anymore. The sun shall not strike them, nor any heat." I'll tell you what, I've been in Charleston for a little over a year now. I thought I knew what it was to feel warm outside. You guys are ridiculous. Why would you live here? Like, it's a swamp outside, and it's hot, and it's humid. And it's what? It's beautiful, I mean, I guess. Everything's wet all the time. You walk outside, you just get wet. I mean, it rains, guess what? Everything floods out. I mean, it's nice and everything, but shoot. All right. "For the Lamb who is in the midst of the throne will shepherd them and lead them to living fountains of water. He leads me beside still waters," is what David prophesied in Psalm, was that 23-ish, right? 23. And then here, in a picture of heaven, is no longer still waters showing safety and security, but flowing water. Interesting change in the picture there. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. I don't get caught up in verse 17. There is a slight nuance difference between what we see here and what you see in chapter 21 and 22. There shall be no more tears, and God shall wipe away every tear from their eyes. So which one is it? Are we going to cry and we're comforted, or are we not going to cry anymore? Some say him wiping away our tears indicates that we're talking about a spiritual symbol of what we experience here in the church. So when we're looking in verse 15, 16, and 17, this isn't heaven. This is the church age seen in a symbolic way. Makes sense, but whatever. And then the end of Revelation is us no longer in the church spiritual age. Now we're actually in heaven. So that's one nuance that people have kind of picked apart. I don't think that's a big deal to me anyway. The idea is we are in a safe, secure, loved, heavenly state is the implication, right? One thing to mention here about the Great Tribulation. If you look at... Yeah, I mean, that's the meaning behind it, right? Some people are kind of like, well, is that now or is that in the future? I don't make a big deal about it. The Great Tribulation. If you just do a search on the Great Tribulation on Google, which is, by the way, the worst way to do research on this kind of stuff, eschatology, the study of the last times, the end times, this is not going to be found on Google very reliably. Google is great. I mean, you can find anything in a split second, but there's so much error about this entire book, this entire thought process online, you can get lost in a rabbit hole of error for a good long while. The Great Tribulation here is talking about a time of turmoil and difficulty upon the earth from which people were redeemed, right? So the Great Tribulation in Revelation chapter 3, if we remember, go back in our minds now to what chapter 3 was like, all the messages to the seven churches in Asia. And here's one part, verse 10, because you have kept my command to persevere, I also will keep you from the hour of trial, which shall come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth. So one possible meaning of what the Great Tribulation here is in this text is that great hour of trial that comes upon the whole world. If it was told to people that were living at the end of the first century, I'm going to keep you from this hour of trial, it implies that hour of trial may have been very close to their lifetimes. It wouldn't make much sense to say, I'm going to save you from the trouble that will happen 3,000 years from now. Well, great, we're dead now. So what? So the Great Tribulation seen in this context very well took place in the first century. One more thing to kind of connect this dot. Now, this is going to be specifically to Jim Lamb over there. He loves this passage. Daniel chapter 12. Daniel is confusing. It's more confusing than Revelation, if you ask me. This is my personal opinion. Daniel chapter 12, though, not so much. If you look in verse 1. At that time, Michael shall stand up. We'll see that in just a few moments. The great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since the time, such as never was since there was a nation, even to that time. And at that time, your people shall be delivered, every one who is found written in the book that's familiar to us. And many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, the dead will rise, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. Those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. Right, Jim? All right. It's his favorite passage, I think, from Daniel, right? Verse 4, but you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase. So we connect those two dots to show the fact that Daniel was given a glimpse of this in a way. in a spiritual type, at least we see this connection. Right. 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 Absolutely. Seems like God has a continuous way to reveal something for the benefit of encouraging us to keep faithful, right? Okay, so we're going to pause here for the morning. I'm going to let you go early. How about that? Instead of late this time. And we'll go on to chapter 8. He kind of remembers what he was doing in chapter 8 and goes back to our last seal that we're going to unleash. And that last seal will be a segue into seven trumpets sounding. So we'll go into that next week, Lord willing. Thank you very much for your attention and discussion, and we'll be dismissed now for about 15 minutes.
Thank you.